The Dose of Fat, show number 136 for Friday, July 20th, 2018. Aloha, and welcome to Fat Bike Radio. I'm your Tio Gomez, coming to you from the Big Whiskey. You're stuck with me because Leia's racing out in Snowshoe, West Virginia, Mountain Mama, at the Mountain Bike Championships of the United States of America. And the interview that I just recorded yesterday with Spinner and DJ Birch is going to reignite the oil slick of the Black Ribbon Radio Hour, maybe a little later. So tonight, we present an interview with Gary Meyer, who's a winter trail guru out in Bend, Oregon. And we'll also talk to him about his trip, his race for the Tour Divide. After that, we talk to Roy Kranz, who is a three-time winner of the Dirty Kansas 200 in the fat bike category. Coming up right after this. Hey, please welcome to the radio program, Mr. Gary Meyer.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So, Gary, you are involved with both riding and trail advocacy, specifically for fat bikes in Oregon. You just finished the Tour Divide, but we're first going to talk to you about how you and your trail group work together with land managers to create groomed trails at the Winoga Snowplay area in Bend, Oregon.
Yeah. I live in Bend, Oregon, as you said. Bend is surrounded by the Deschutes National Forest. We're extremely lucky in that our forest managers believe in recreation. I've been riding snow for many years. Started fat biking, I guess 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And all of our snowmobile trails are open to fat bikes, which is a bonus. The downside is you're riding a 20, 30 foot wide trail. And if you're riding on the weekends, you have snowmobiles ripping by you. I met and talked to quite frequently one of the rangers out there patrolling in the winter, and he ended up inviting me to a trail user group meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Which the Forest Service, again, they're big on recreation, so they have meetings every other month with the equestrians, the snowmobilers, the hikers, the cross-country skiers, and Central Oregon Trail Alliance, which is our mountain bike group. So he invited me to one of those meetings and bring my fat bike and explain to all these people what these, the crazy group of people out riding bikes on snow were doing. And at that point, there was probably, 15, 20 of us in town.
Mm-hmm.
I started going to these meetings and it kind of parlays into a question you have further down, but I started realizing there was an opportunity. All these other groups had trails. Why couldn't we have winter trails? We have great summertime trails. Why couldn't we have winter trails? About the same time, one of the local cross-country areas were having some conflicts with people on fat bikes riding their groomed trails. Legally, there's nothing they can do, because the way our forest district sees it is all non-motorized trails are open to all non-motorized use. Nevertheless, it was still a conflict, especially at the trailheads. If you get away from the trailheads, it's not much of an issue. The president of that ski club approached me and said, would you be willing to work with the ski club to come up with a solution? So we met several times over the course of the year with the board of directors for that club, trying to figure out a way to make it work. Long story short, the best solution we found was across the street from that ski area. Let's all work on the Forest Service to let the Forest Service room trails for the fat bikes over there. And so that's what we did. It took, it was approximately a year and a half or 2 years before we got our first trial permit. And they, with that permit, we were allowed to groom up to, I think it was 6 miles. The first year we started grooming, around December 1st, had the trails ready to go about Christmas.
And what did you start grooming with right away? This is probably,
you know, I guess I should back up a little bit, but yeah, I can answer that question. We started grooming with, you know, through connections. Somebody donated us, 1998 Ski-Doo Tundra.
Mm-hmm.
Nice little lightweight snowmobile. And we built a drag for that. And then we built, you know, the classic roller that everybody uses.
Sure.
So between those two implements and the one groomer, we started grooming.
Because grooming is a whole nother subject that it's a highly evolving, moving target where they're really doing incredible stuff, just especially in the last couple of years.
Definitely. Absolutely. To back up a little bit on the long story to get to that point, when the Nordic Club and I started putting pressure on the Forest Service to let us groom, the Forest Service said, well, like any of the other groups that have trails here, you have to become a nonprofit. You have to have insurance, you know, all these hoops they make you jump through.
Right. All the, yeah.
The Nordic Club said, well, it wouldn't be a really good fit, and we might have some members that have issues with it, but you, you know, if you make this happen, we'd be happy to have you be part of our group.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was like, well, yeah, that's going to be a problem. So I approached CODA at that point, Central Oregon Trail Alliance, and talked to the then president and said, hey, you know, this is what I want to do. I'm on a mountain bike. I should be, you know, this should be part of CODA. Let's make it part of CODA.
Got it.
And it turned out that one of the members had started going to some of the fat bike summits and collecting information because, you know, they could see the writing on the wall.
Right, the fat bike summits that IMBA partners with, the brands at QBP, Gary Stolquist.
The first couple fat bike summits were like in the Jackson Teton area.
Uh huh.
I know Fitzgerald Bikes were the main instigators in them, and I don't know if IMBA was involved at that point.
Gotcha.
It was a year or two later, I think IMBA got involved. Nevertheless, he had started going to these summits and collecting information, trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to do this? And then I basically raised the flag and said, I wanted to spearhead this and get it going. They agreed to it, so now I was part of CODA, which gave me all the bits I needed to satisfy the Forest Service.
Right, your 401c and your insurance and whatnot.
Exactly. So then, you know, then we started grooming. The first year, we got trails ready to go for opening day, which was just after Christmas. In that opening day, it was 45 degrees at the trailhead. And within a week, it had all melted and it rained the rest of the year.
Oh, man.
So the first year wasn't a whopping success. And our permit, the way they did it, and it was the first 3 years we had this trial permit. And we were only, our trails were open January 1st to the end of February.
Got it.
So it was a 2 month window. It, you know, irritated a lot of people because the snow usually hits, you know, like the second week of December. So, you know, we missed the whole Christmas break and we missed a lot of the good snow in March. But, you know, hey, they were allowing us to groom, so I wasn't too upset.
Mm-hmm.
The trails, you know, they've been a huge success. And, you know, like I said, 6 or 7 years ago, there were maybe 15 of us in town. Now you see so many fat bikes, it's unbelievable. And people out, you know, our lower trails, when we get snow closer to town, people will go out and just, you know, push as far as they can. The next person pushes a little further, the next person pushes a little further, and pretty soon there's a loop everybody's riding.
Nice.
So there's self-groomed trails too, happen a lot. And we've also got snowshoe trails. We're legal to ride on the snowshoe trails, so
yeah.
A lot of people ride snowshoe trails.
Fat biker's best friends, snowshoers.
Yeah. So that's kind of the rough history of how it got going. It was kind of a, you know, be in the right place at the right time type of thing.
And you went through the mountain bike advocacy culture side, or just say mountain bike culture versus cross-country ski culture to get there. So separate trails groomed in the way that mountain bikers like to ride, because
exactly
big wide ski trails, they are alluring though. I mean, that's out there. And
they're alluring, especially for the beginner.
Sure.
And, you know, if you want to put on a race-type event, they're alluring because now you have passing room, because on groomed single track, you don't really have passing room unless you groom areas for that. We've had groups talking to us about putting on races now, and the way we would do it is we'd have our trail pop out on the snowmobile trail and then pop back, so you have... Every once in a while, you have a wide area to...
Right. Yeah, the I think the best short track kind of future, not big, long, ultra-marathon style racing, but if we take series racing and put them on cross-country ski trails as a loppet, so they run all their cross-country ski trails, and then the bikes go... And then they regroom everything. They would have to regroom everything anyway. So, but that's a tough nut to crack. And it's interesting to hear, even in, 2,000 miles away from the situation that I live in, which is very much the same. Cross-country skiers do not want to see bikes on their trails.
Right.
And we have... separate facilities, and very much like your situation.
Yeah.
So
there is a race. We have a race here every year, the Great Nordine, and the way they're running it, it's just that it's the skiers go first in the morning, and then the fat bikes go afterwards, and it works great.
Yeah, I've heard that called a loppet up in. It seems to be on that upper Wisconsin Minnesota border. They have several of these. I don't know where that word comes from, but that's the gist of how they run it, and it seems to make a lot of sense. And that's how the Fat Bike Berkey became such a large race, is they run their huge 50,000 people ski on this 47K track, and then they the next week let the bikes do the race. So, and it's the end of the season, and you know, spring's right around the corner in March in northern Wisconsin. So how many miles do you currently have at the Winter Fun Park, and what are the numbers of riders?
So we're currently permitted to groom up to 11 miles. We have a outer loop, which is 6 miles, and then the inner loop is mapped at 3 miles, but it goes through some open area, so we kind of change it around and, you know, extend it to give us the full 11 miles.
Gotcha.
The outer loop we keep, it's pretty tight in the trees, so we don't have to deal with wind drift.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's in our area, wind drift is a big problem because we get light, fluffy powder snow.
Gotcha.
In the shorter loop, we stick in the trees, but we go out in the clearings and do some fun, you know, swoops down through a valley type riding. So 11 miles.
Nice. And what are you grooming with today? Do you have a track sled, or are you still grooming?
No, we have two. We have an older Bearcat, you know, wide track machine, so a 20-inch wide track.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, we got a really nice donation and got us a new Polaris Titan, which is another, you know, wide track utility machine. And then behind that, we have a selection of implements we've been building over the last couple of years.
Cool. Yeah, it's a real challenge.
We have a roller. We have a drag that you can, you know, adjust the teeth down in to kind of resurface harder snow. We have a drag that's made out of basically rock screen.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of you look at the implements that everybody's building, and that's what we've built.
Sure. And you have the most challenging style of snow. That light, fluffy snow is hard to get compressed and put enough energy into it where it melts a little bit and refreezes into something harder.
Right. Which is why we found having two machines, two people go out at once. The front machine is like stirring and churning the snow. The back machine is packing it and laying down the comb.
Shaken and stirred and then refrozen.
Yeah, you basically have to beat all the air out of the snow is what it amounts to. So the, you know, the crystals will break down and then lock to each other and form that crust that we need.
So are you what are your guidelines for when to ride and when not to ride in the winter? Are you using IMBA's best practices, or
we kind of based it off of IMBA's best practices, but you know, we've evolved from that. You know, I think IMBA says something like 10 PSI or less. We encourage 5 or 6 or less.
Gotcha.
PSI. You know, 6 PSI is kind of the max we say people should ride with.
That's a good point.
We've had a lot of discussions, and we ended up with 6 just because occasionally you can ride harder, but we recommend 4. We also, it's 3.8 or wider tires.
Right.
You know, we have signage at the trailhead, and, you know, every winter through our Facebook group and through the COTA webpage and such, we pump out all sorts of information to people all the time. And then we encourage our users to educate others, you know?
That's what it's all about.
If you see somebody struggling, you stop, you know, it's the fat bike handshake, as we call it. It's when you reach down and you squeeze their tire.
That's I could see a cartoon in the future about that. That's kind of a funny thing.
Yeah, you know, you see somebody struggling, you say hi to them, and then you squeeze their tire. And
yeah, you could probably go down a little bit. Yeah, and carrying a tire gauge with you would be a good thing.
Yeah.
I guess I have one on my pump, so that would work.
Yeah, we have a at our trailhead next to the donation box, there's a tire gauge cabled onto the box.
Oh, nice.
You were asking about numbers of riders.
Yeah.
We started out, and the second year we had a trial permit, which was the first year we had good snow. We had, you know, counters on the trail, and we were seeing on weekends, you know, between 15 and 20 riders a day, which isn't fantastic. Last year, we were seeing 15 to 20 riders in the first hour and a half of the day.
Wow. Which means everyone after that is a new person and is growth and could be beds and heads, could be people traveling there to recreate.
Definitely.
And that's a big deal to decision makers, land managers, and the local business community.
Yeah. There were, on peak weekends last season, we were seeing up to 100 riders a day.
That's awesome.
And that those counts were a combination of the trail counter, and we had volunteers that would sit from 8 a.m. to noon counting. We wouldn't bother counting past noon because sometimes, you know, the snow would be getting soft. And...
Sure. Well, that is a great success story. And that's a perfect transition for us to talk about. You just finished the Tour Divide.
Yes, I did.
And for those that don't know, this is a bikepacking race competition that goes from the border of Canada to the border of Mexico, all along the Continental Divide through the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah, it actually starts north of the border. It starts in Banff, which is about 250 maybe from the north of the border.
Oh, man. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And so you finished how many days, and what are the details of this adventure?
Yeah, it is an adventure. I finished in 25 days, 5 hours. My goal, this is my second attempt. My goal for this attempt was to finish, number one. Number two, to be in the mid 20 day range. So I made both.
You nailed it.
I think I averaged something like 108 miles a day.
Wow. For 25 days straight.
Yeah. Yeah.
I kind of followed along on the Facebook feed and saw pictures, many of which you were quite wet, like rain and rain and rain and rain.
Yeah, and that's kind of typical. The beginning of the event is quite wet. Towards the end, you know, one of the big, or in the second half of the race, the big fear is rain, because once you start to get into Colorado and New Mexico, when it rains, the mud is this peanut butter clay, and it just brings you to a halt.
Oh, man.
Luckily, we had a little of that. Well, not luckily we had a little, but luckily we only had a little mud. Was that in Wyoming? I think it was in Wyoming we had a little mud. It wasn't, and we had some that was not the peanut butter in Canada.
Yeah.
But it slowed you down dramatically. But in the second half of the race, the southern half of the race, we had, it was just so amazing. We had tailwinds and dry trails, so it was great.
Killer. So, 25 days that you were out there, I had just envisioned something like this as, like I said, an adventure or like a spiritual journey, like that, what people dream about. So tell me, if you can, the best moment, most ethereal, inspiring moment of your Tour Divide experience?
So other than finishing, there were a lot. There was a place that we climbed out of Breckenridge up over Boreas Pass, and then you drop down the other side and you hit this little community called Como, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And from Como, Colorado to Hartzell, I don't know how fast the tailwind was, but riding that section felt like we were on motos. We went, it was, I don't know, I think it was 30 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And we covered it in just over an hour.
Wow.
It was like an hour and a half, I think, we covered 30 miles. And it was just one of those, woohoo, I could do anything moments.
Yeah, like, so,
and then we turned a corner and had it as a crosswind, and that kind of deflated it. But there were lots of times like that where you hit something and it was just amazing.
Cool.
You'd be on such a high.
Well, on the other side of that coin is it, I know you've only been back for a couple of weeks, is it too soon to talk about the darkest moment of your adventure?
That's an easy one.
Yeah.
So we had climbed, I climbed the Indiana Pass, which is the highest pass at 11,900 feet. You drop down to, I mean, I was going to say town, but it's not a town, but Horka.
Mm-hmm.
Horka, you get on pavement, you do this pavement climb, and then you drop down the pavement, get off the pavement, ride about a mile, and now you're crossing into New Mexico. Well, coming up that pavement climb, my rear wheel was kind of clicking. On the just paved downhill descent, going through the corners, it's like my whole back wheel is squishy. You know, it's almost like I got a flat tire.
Uh-huh.
Pull off the pavement, look at my wheel, and the non-drive side spokes were loose. Like, oh, shit. So I'm tightening those up. And, of course, that pulls the wheel over, so I have to tighten up the drive side. As I'm tightening up the drive side spokes, I look down, and every drive side spoke had a crack about a half an inch on either side of the spoke.
On the rim, right? I think I saw
the
picture.
On the rim, there was a crack a half an inch long on both sides of the spoke, all the drive side spokes.
So your wheel is toast.
It's pretty toast. So with the maps and stuff I had, the road I just got off of, I had no idea where it went because the maps didn't cover that.
Sure, they stopped. Yeah.
So I was entering Carson National Forest, and I had about 90 miles of rough trail to the next town, which pretty much didn't have any services like a bike shop.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a couple guys there, and we decided to stick together, and they talked me into just keep going forward. So we went forward like 20 more miles, camped for the night, got up in the morning. I got up thinking, I'm going to turn around and go back. The other people talked me into going forward,
mm-hmm.
which I'm eternally grateful for. And so I just kept going forward, and it was, you know, on the descent, I'd just go really, really slow, listening to my wheel pinging and popping.
Yeah. just babying it as much as you can, huh?
Yeah, just baby it as much as I can. About every 25 miles, I'd have to true it up enough to keep it from rubbing on the frame. Made it those 90 miles, and then we had like 100 and... When we had a fire reroute, so Santa Fe for us was closed to entry, so we had to ride 60 miles around that on pavement. And then there's a section from, I think it's Cuba to Grants, New Mexico, that's pavement.
Mm-hmm.
And on the pavement, I only had to true it up about every 7,500 miles. And when we got to a place where we had cell coverage, I called ahead, ordered a wheel, had it shipped to Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, 3.5 days after finding my wheel broken, I was able to put a new wheel on and keep going. But the lowest moment was finding that cracked rim.
Yeah, yeah, because then your whole, at that point you think, well, my tour could be over here. And it had to feel really good when you could jump on that bike and not baby that wheel again.
Oh my gosh, yes. It was amazing. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that amazing adventure, and thanks for sharing your highs and lows through there. So what's next for you?
Let's see. September, we're going to go to Colorado, do some riding in Colorado. And then come home in October and start prepping for the winter trails.
Nice.
Go out, flag the trails, remove blowdowns. In general, get ready.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to share both the trail advocacy stories and your Tour Divide story. And thanks for coming on the show. We're going to have links to the information about the Bend, Oregon Fat Bike Trails in the show notes. And party on, my friend.
Excellent. Thank you.
Next up, we welcome Roy Kranz, the 3-time Dirty Kanza Fat Bike Category Champion, right after this. Hey, please welcome to the show the 3-time Dirty Kanza 200 winner of the Fat Bike Classification, Mr. Roy Kranz.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm excited to be here.
Man, it's amazing. 3 times you've won this race. And you are you live in Michigan?
Yes.
Whereabouts in Michigan are you from? What part?
Midland, kind of right in the middle of the Lower Peninsula.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we have some friends in and bike testers over in Manistee.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely a nice area.
And so why don't we start, since you're from the UP, you got to have a great first fat bike. How'd you get into fat bike riding?
Well, actually, I'm from the Lower Peninsula, but we get a fair amount of snow here, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard about how much fun the fat biking was. So in around 2013, I bought a used Salsa Muckluck, and it was too small, but it was still a blast, and I was kind of hooked at that point.
And were you a bike racer before you got into fat biking?
A little bit. You know, I wasn't super serious about it, but had definitely done some of the Michigan races and enjoyed them. Didn't really know what I was doing for training, so didn't have great results, but was having fun, and that's probably the most important thing anyway.
So what was your first fat bike race?
2015, I did the Farmhand Fat Bike Race at Cannonsburg Ski Resort, and I've done that the last 4 years, and that's pretty much the only winter fat bike race that I've done, and it's a lot of fun. It's a challenging course, and a lot of the big Michigan names come out, Matt Acker and Jordan Wakely, and there's some pros that have been there, so it's a fun mix.
Hmm, Cool. Yeah, and that's a race that's been around for a long time, and they hold a serious race and they hold a team race, right, where it's not quite so serious and fun.
Yeah, I'm only aware of the Great Lakes Series race. I didn't know they had are you talking about the one in the summer, that the farm race?
No, the farmer's race, I thought, had a team category, too, for in addition
to
just...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the same race. It's just you can do a two-man team and split up the miles. I thought you meant a separate race altogether, but yeah.
No, just that enduro format, we call it in Wisconsin, but... It's more my speed. So how do you do when you race head to head against Wakely or Acker?
Oh my God, those guys are complete animals. I mean, so 1 year at Farmhand, I was seventh overall, and I still got lapped by Acker and somebody else. I mean, those guys, they're unbelievable. They're at a whole nother level for sure.
Oh yeah, Jordan Wakely is like, wow, crazy strong rider.
Absolutely, he's a total beast.
So now we are we're 5 years down your fat bike road. What kind of fat bike are you racing today?
Well, I actually don't own a mountain bike, but I have two fat bikes. I've got a Salsa Bear Grease and a Salsa Bucksaw. The first 2 years at Kansas, I rode the Bucksaw, and then I thought, probably don't need full suspension, and maybe be a little bit lighter on the Bear Grease, and I'm really enjoying that bike at the moment.
Cool. Here we are in the bonus round. We're going to give you the lightning round, or the, we might call it the, you can pimp your tire sponsor round. But I have a lightning question for you. If you could have only one set of fat bike tires, what would they be? And you can actually have like one for the front and one for the rear. So it's two choices possible.
Yeah. That's obviously a tough question, because the 45 North is great for the winter, but I do mostly the non-winter stuff. So I would say the Terravale Coronado, the 26x4. It's a brand new tire. I ran them at Kansas this year. They're fast, they're durable, and I do love those tires. Those are amazing.
Huh, cool. So tell us about Dirty Kansas, or actually, they should actually call this race the Dirty Kranza, because that's your last name, and you've won it three times. So it's like Super Bowl of gravel, right?
It's absolutely fantastic. Emporia, Kansas is where it's held, and it's kind of a magical place. The whole town embraces the racers that come. There are people at their houses that you ride by that are, you know, have signs, and they stay out there all day cheering people on, and they give you water. And then at the end, the townspeople line the streets. It feels like the Tour de France. I mean, heck, you can even test yourself against stars of the Tour de France. This year we had Jens Voigt there. Guy finished 17 Tour de Frances. He's won the yellow jersey twice. He's known for the famous phrase "shut up, legs." And I actually got to ride with him for an extended time in the last part of the race, and even beat him, which was for sure the highlight of my biking career. It was amazing. But the race itself is pretty awesome. It's over 200 miles of rough gravel. Approximately 9,000 feet of climbing, which you may not expect when you think of Kansas.
Sure.
The temps are often in the 90s. There's vicious headwinds. There's unbridged rivers you have to cross. I mean, it's really a wonderful adventure.
And it's the Flint Hills of Kansas, right? And isn't this a course or the terrain that's so famous for cutting up tires and whatnot?
Yeah, it's you see people on the side of the course all the time with tires that they're fixing or changing. And I think 1 year, Matt Acker, who you mentioned before, mm-hmm. I think he had seven flat tires. And he had, you know, the next year he went to a bigger tire and didn't have problems. But, it's crazy.
And this year you got there and you...
had a bad tire experience. Why don't you tell us about that? Because my buddy Adam helped you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we got there, and we always do a pre-ride the day before, just kind of check out the beginning and the end of the course, and everything went fine. Didn't notice any problems. We got back in the hotel room, and I was trying to figure out what to do on this Chase Lounge. Salsa had Chase the Chase, where you could get your picture taken on this antique Chase Lounge that they put out about 180 miles into the course, and wanted to come up with something unique. So I'm at my bike, and I'm trying to figure out a pose, and I noticed this huge nail sticking out of my tire, and it had obviously sealed up, so it wasn't leaking air or fluid or anything, but obviously I freaked out. I mean, I didn't want to start this race with a big long nail sticking in my tire. So I called all the bike shops in town. Nobody had a single fat bike tire for sale. So I went to Gravel City Adventure and Supply Company, and Adam Blake was there, and I said, I don't know what to do. And he goes, dude, I'm gonna drive home. I'm going to take the tires off my bike, and I'm going to hook you up. I'm like, oh, I love this guy. It was incredible. So, unbelievably, he had the same tires, the Terravel Coronados, that I was running, the durable version. I mean, it was like it couldn't have worked out better. And for him to do that on a day that probably is their, I would guess, busiest day of the year at the shop, it was mind-blowing that he was willing to do that for me.
Yeah, I've known Adam for a long time, and we're really good friends. He'll give you the shirt off of his back. He's that kind of dude.
He essentially did.
Yeah. Well, the tires off of his bike. It's kind of the same thing, right? So you take down the fat bike division, and it looks like I kind of skimmed the results. It looks like you beat the next fastest fat bike by an hour and a half, 2 hours, something like that.
Yeah. Like an hour and 35 this year, and that guy's an animal too, Tom Scott. Like 2 years ago, he was ninth overall at Kansas. So I was definitely worried about him. I do, you know, to maybe explain the hour and a half thing, it may have been partially because there was a train that was blocking people. And my guess is he got held up at that train, and it would have been closer. But still, I mean, it was, I lucked out and got through before the train blocked the tracks, which was nice. So, but yeah, the competition level is, even in the fat bike category, there's not a lot of people, but there are some heavy hitters, and keeps me motivated for sure.
And how far off from the overall winner was your time?
So the first year, it was about 2 hours, but I was 35th overall out of about 1,100. So, I mean, I'm, you know, still finishing high in the overall, but, man, the overall people are amazing. Ted King won it in 2016 and 2018. And this year, I was actually almost 3 hours behind him. So it sounds really bad, but still in the top 100, so I'm pretty happy with that.
It doesn't sound that bad. In 200 miles within 3 hours, that's pretty good.
Yeah, the first
actually.
2 years it was 2 hours, and in the third one it was almost 3 hours. 10:44 he did it, and it was 13:33 for me. So
gotcha. And most people, most cyclists would say, oh, they have a huge advantage with the riding the gravel bike with, you know, 32s or something on it. It really isn't. And probably they can get those bikes 5 pounds lighter than the bike you're riding, something like that.
Oh, my bike's at least 30 pounds, so I'm guessing that they could get it 15, 17 pounds on a expensive gravel bike. I don't know. But, you know, they're more likely to flat, too. So
this is true.
And it's not quite as comfortable on what they're riding over the course of the day. I mean, that probably makes the difference too.
Indeed. So we talked a little bit about, now probably Dirty Kansas is your favorite race, right? Because you won it three times.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, I love it.
And you said you hadn't had a lot of winter of fat bike racing experience. Do you have any, like, do you want to try any of the big races, like
the Arrowhead 135 or the Iditarod Trail Invitational or even something like, only 47K at Fatbike Berkey.
Well, I can tell you that I tried the Discobia race this year, and it chewed me up and spit me out. I had a flat that I tried to pump back up. It was tubeless. It was only about less than 20 miles into the race. And I had met a guy out there that told me he had a flat, and he got frostbite on his hands changing his tire. And it was, the windshields were in the negative 30s, and so it was almost a blessing to get a flat and be out of that race. I did end up, supporting my friend who was in the race, which actually was a lot of fun. But I don't really have any big plans to go back. I do like the long, hard races, but the winter ones, I gotta take a break from the bike racing at some point too on the home front, or the wife won't be real thrilled. So. Winter's not a bad time to take off.
So, when you're training for Dirty Kanza, where do you peak out? What's the longest training ride that you do for that 200-mile race?
I think, I usually will plan, and it's funny that you called it this, but I have a Dirty Kanza ride that I do a month before the race, typically, uh-huh. And that's 170 miles on a gravel route near my area. And I'll also ride the trainer for up to 8 hours or more at a time in the winter, watching Netflix or something like that. I usually get about 5,000 miles in from November until June when the race is.
Wow. Wow. 8 hours on a trainer, dude. Ow.
Yeah, 140 miles on the trainer. It's you got to have a series that you're watching to keep that going.
Goodness. And you live in the center of where you could be outside, but are you just not a winter person?
I mean, I winter camp, and I climb in the White Mountains of New Hampshire in the winter. We have one more year. We'll have all of those mountains finished. It's I don't know. I mean, I do want to do some more winter races, but probably not the ones you mentioned.
Right.
I'd like to do a few more of the Great Lakes series where you can be done in 3 hours or whatever.
Sure.
And
yeah, you know what it would be a really good one is Polar Roll up in Marquette. That's a
I need to get up there. That Todd Poquette is awesome. I love that guy.
Yeah, that's a really well-run event. So
I'm going. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Our show's co-host, Leah Schneeberger, she won the women's pro race last year.
That's awesome.
So Leah's this month going to race in the national championship. So she's in an oxygen deprivation tank right now.
Wow.
Training for, she's super focused. So that's why you're stuck with me for this interview.
Nice.
So you have been a fantastic guest. I really appreciate you coming on. And there's going to be a video that you put together about the race that actually shows you winning, so our listeners will be able to experience your winning ride through your eyes. And there's footage with Jens Voigt, and it's well done. So I appreciate you letting us link that in there and taking the time to talk to us today.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. You keep it rolling fat, my brother.
All right, I will. You too.
That's our show this week. Check us out on iTunes and Instagram at fatbike.com with the dot spelled out and stuff. Felices caminos, amigos.
I'm Amrith the Quest with the Fat Papa Costume with Huge Scan News.